Welcome back. Last time, I talked about the transition during the second millennium BC between the late Longshan culture through this semi-legendary Xia dynasty that itself provides a transition into the historically and archaeologically known Shang dynasty of ancient China. I talked about the development of urbanism, the characteristic development of Chinese cities through time, beginning in the Xia and continuing through the Shang dynasty. Some of the characteristics, the steady increase in scale of urbanism from Longshan to Xia to Shang, the elaboration of rule and of the cultural trappings of rule in China during the second millennium BC. Today, I want to talk about one particular characteristic of that development, the development of political systems in China, and that's the appearance of the earliest form of the Chinese writing system and its implications, the implications both of the appearance and of the context of this early Chinese writing, for our understanding of Shang society and Shang politics. One of the most significant archaeological finds during excavations at the last capital of the Shang, at Yinzhu, the modern city of Anyang, were what is known as oracle bones. These are flat fragments of cattle scapulae, shoulder blades, sometimes turtle shells, with a very early form of Chinese writing inscribed on them. In fact, people had known that oracle bones came from the area around Anyang, at least since the late 19th century. They were known to have been found in that area. The excavation at Yinzhu from the 1920s onward finally placed the oracle bones in an archaeological and thus a cultural context. More than 150,000 oracle bone fragments have been recovered from excavations to date, especially at Yinzhu, at Anyang. And so these provide us with an extraordinarily important and rich corpus of the very earliest Chinese writing. As I said in the last lecture, it's possible that symbols found scratched onto pottery from early Do occupied between 1800 and 1600 BC are precursors to those symbols found on the oracle bone texts. This would actually connect the oracle bone inscriptions with cultural processes and events in the Xia or even the final Longshan period as well. We also know that three oracle bone fragments had been found at Erligang near Zhengzhou, the first of the Shang dynasty capitals. The context in which they had been found at Erligang is a little unclear, but they did exist there. But the vast majority of these texts, samples of early Chinese writing, come, as I said, from the very end of the Shang period, from the last capital of the Shang at Yinzhu, modern Anyang. And thus we have to accept that what we know of Chinese writing refers almost entirely to this period at the end of the Shang dynasty, close to 1000 BC. This relative lack of evidence for the gradual development of the Chinese writing system does puzzle archaeologists. And some have even claimed that it implies a borrowing of the idea of writing by the Chinese from somewhere else, possibly from Mesopotamia, earlier in the second millennium BC. That's possible. But we also have to remember that we have lots of other cases. We've already seen other cases where the appearance of writing seems pretty abrupt. It seemed relatively abrupt in Egypt, in Crete, with Cretan hieroglyphics and then Linear A. With Harappan, it appears fairly quickly. But in none of those cases would we necessarily claim that these cultures borrowed the idea of writing from elsewhere. One thing that we always have to remember is that in many areas, in most areas really, the archaeological record is partial. It's fragmentary. We have to remember that there are so many things that we don't know yet about the archaeological record in these areas. And of course, that's one of the things that makes archaeology so exciting, because there's always more to do and always more to find. There is some limited evidence, some archaeological evidence, for even earlier symbol use, perhaps I'll say, in the Yangshao and Longshan periods during the late 4th and the 3rd millennia BC. Signs scratched on pottery from two different areas of East and Southeast China seem to be a part of two different systems of symbols. However, these two, perhaps we'll call them scripts, do not resemble each other, and they also do not resemble later Chinese written characters. So we believe that these writing systems, if such they were, seem to have died out. We have to remember, there are, of course, a number of things that people can use symbols for, markings for. They might have been owner's marks, just ways of representing the ownership of the pots that they were found on. Almost like a brand. They could be uses of magic to protect the contents of those pots from supernatural harm. This is something else that people do in different parts of the world. Not every pattern system of symbol use can be called a writing system. The symbols on oracle bones, let's go back to the Shang, let's go back to Yinzhu, to Anyang, to the end of the second millennium BC. The symbols on oracle bones from Shang centers, like Yinzhu, on the other hand, are in many cases ancestral to later Chinese written characters. In total, about 1,400 of the 2,500 Shang characters that are known seem to be ancestral to later written characters in Chinese. And indeed, phonetic and rhyming evidence from the oracle bones demonstrates that the Shang spoken language was ancestral to modern Chinese as well. So we have continuity in the writing system and also evidence for continuity in the spoken language, which is very useful and interesting for archaeologists. This 3,000 to 4,000 year process of development between almost 2000 BC at Early Do and the present, this process of development has generated the longest continuous written tradition in the world and an extraordinary body of literature. The contexts of early Chinese writing are quite different from those of its Mesopotamian and Egyptian counterparts. Shang writing, Shang texts are actually found in two different contexts. First, there are some written characters found as monographs on bronze vessels, those bronze vessels that I talked about last time that play a central role in sacrifice and feasting for the Shang elite. So we do find written characters cast into these bronze vessels. Far more informatively, though, as the oracle bones, as texts concerned with divination inscribed on ox scapula shoulder blades or turtle shells. And this question of divination is central to our understanding of these oracle bone writings. Divination involves attempts to determine the course of future events. That's always important for a ruler if it can be done. The form of divination in this case, on cattle scapulae, shoulder blades, is called scapulomancy. Sometimes it's called plastromancy when applied to turtle shells. Just the material is different. The writing system and the procedure are the same in both cases. Questions involving future events are scratched onto the surface of the bone or shell using the writing system, and then that piece of shoulder blade, ox shoulder blade, or turtle shell is heated over a fire. The cracks in the bone or shell, the result from this heating, are then interpreted as responses to the questions that were posed by the writing. This general form of divination is found in a variety of societies in different parts of the world, not merely in China. But only the Chinese developed a writing system, at least in part, to specify the questions that were to be asked about the future. The contexts and questions on Chinese oracle bones provide an immense amount of information on the workings of the Shang state, the assumptions and rules of Shang leadership, and the ideological basis of state rule during the Shang. One thing I might note in this context, at this point, is that the longest Shang oracle text is 160 characters, which is actually fairly substantial. What I particularly want to do is compare that to the longest Harappan text from the Indus Valley, which, as I noted in an earlier lecture, is only 10 characters long. And this will give us some idea of the challenge for those archaeologists and epigraphers interested in Harappan. This gives us an idea of the challenge of coming to conclusions about the language in use or the content of inscriptions when one only has 10 characters to deal with. Even given later familiarity with the Chinese writing system, we can see the texts so much longer, up to 160 characters long, are, all other things being equal, probably going to contain a lot more information. So, what can we say about then the use and the content of these early forms of Chinese writing? Well, the first thing that I want to note, unsurprisingly, is that the oracle bone inscription seemed to have been the province of the ruler and perhaps to a limited degree other members of the high nobility and concern the doings of the Chinese court, of the Shang court. There is very, very limited later historical evidence that indicates that such practices may have taken place outside royal sites. But it's unclear the degree to which this actually would have been true during the Shang period. It's also unclear whether the ruler actually undertook the divination himself. That is, whether he actually wrote the questions, heated the surface of the material in a fire, and then interpreted the answers, or whether this was done by particular ritual specialists in divination. But the process was certainly undertaken. It was done in his name, in the name of the ruler. These oracle bone texts and the Chinese writing system during the Shang period, as far as we know, they were not used for accounting purposes. They were not used to record economic transactions. They were not used for diplomacy, for recording history, or for the many other potential uses of such an invention. Of course, this would come later, after the Shang, after the end of the Shang, progressively through time, the use of the writing system of Chinese writing would disseminate such that it was being used for all kinds of purposes in later periods. It is possible that Shang texts of these other sorts, accounts, diplomatic correspondence, even, as I said, love letters as were found in Mesopotamia. It's possible that these other sorts of writing, these other sorts of texts, were recorded on more perishable materials, such as, for example, some form of paper, or, as in later times in China, on strips of bamboo. One of the characters in oracle bone texts may even refer to books made out of these materials. However, to this point, no such texts have survived. Archaeologists can live in hope. But note the implication of this lack of use, as far as we can see at this point. A lack of use of writing for example, keeping accounts. That has implications for the characteristics of Chinese trading systems during this time as well, and economic relationships. And in general, there isn't evidence for the kind of highly developed trading networks in central China at this point that existed in, for example, Mesopotamia during the Uruk period and after. We at this point don't have that evidence. There is certainly the circulation of elite goods over substantial areas, and that had been going on at least since Longshan times. Or for the sort of movement of staple goods over very large areas. That seems to be less developed. Now, it's possible that this may in part be the result of over-concentration by archaeologists on elite sites and the Shang capitals, especially Yinzhou, as I noted last time. On the other hand, it may also be true that there wasn't the demand for staple goods from far away in a relatively well-supplied Huanghe River Valley and in surrounding areas, as was the case in comparatively resource-poor southern Mesopotamia. Of course, one of the things I noted about southern Mesopotamia from the Uruk period onwards was the challenge of supporting large populations and states in an area where the primary resource was the fertile soil, and other resources were in distinct short supply. Maybe trading networks didn't have to develop to the same degree of elaboration at this time period in the Chinese case. The questions asked on the oracle bones, the questions asked about the future then, tended to involve requests for knowledge on whether particular initiatives on the part of the ruler would go well. As I said, the ability to foresee the future. These might include, for example, military campaigns. Would such and such a campaign against people A or city X succeed? The success of embassies and the best time to send out embassies, which do establish at least the existence of contemporary states. Embassies to other states. Sometimes these states are named in the oracle bone inscriptions. At what point should the ruler undertake a tour of the country? And this seems to have happened fairly frequently. It's interesting to note that one of the ways in which Bruce Trigger distinguished city-states from territorial states, one of the characteristics of territorial states is movement around the territory by the ruler as a way of representing the power and legitimacy of the state across its whole territory. At what time should concerts take place? in the court? At what time should sacrifices take place? Would they be propitious? Would they be successful? When should hunts take place? And as we'll see, for succeeding periods, as I'll talk about in my next lecture, warfare, hunting, and sacrifices were conceptually closely related to one another in later periods of Chinese history, and almost certainly for the Shang period as well. I mentioned concerts. Another interesting set of questions address the issue of music at the court. Some oracle bone inscriptions ask of what times and during which seasons certain kind of music should be played. In later Chinese ritual, music was seen as a primary way of adjusting the balance of natural forces in the world, in part because it is a human analog to the natural forces of the wind. Thus, playing the wrong sort of music at various times could bring on drought or storms, destructive storms, while playing favorable music could produce the benign climates important to agriculture and other economic activity. So we see perhaps in these concerns about music, the music to be played in the court, again, the beginnings of theories about the world that would be important after the end of the Shang Dynasty. And I'll, as I said, talk more about these relationships during my next lecture. There are also other kinds of social and cultural data reflected in the oracle bone questions and the elaborations that sometimes go along with them. Although it's often somewhat difficult to tell exactly what these texts are referring to. This is an early form of Chinese writing, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's always easy to interpret. Thus, for example, there's a lot of information provided by the oracle bone inscriptions on the structure of the court itself, especially through references to different official titles for courtiers and civil servants and the relationships between them. Should the Lord Chamberlain visit such and such a town on this day? When should the nobles of the third degree perform a particular sacrifice? These kinds of questions are informative about not merely worries about the future, but about the structure of the Shang court. The court was clearly quite elaborate, a whole variety of different positions and titles, with a structure that was very hierarchical. There seems to have been relatively little distinction between the court and the administrative bureaucracy of the Shang state, with people, always men, shifting from civil servant roles and titles to court attendant roles and titles quite readily. In part, this was probably because kinship remained important in the activities of the Shang nobility for a long period, and people's administrative functions were at least in part dependent upon their lineage and clan connections to the ruler and to each other. This probably inhibited the development of a professional bureaucracy of the kind that we find, for example, in dynastic Egypt, another large territorial state. There are a number of references in the oracle bone inscriptions to the necessity to defend Shang settlements against attack by raiders, especially pastoralists to the north and west. I noted when speaking about Mesopotamia, the pastoralists often come into conflict with the governments of settled states, and the same situation seems to be true in Shang China. There's some evidence in the Oracle Bone inscriptions as well for plans of war and conquest against territories surrounding the Shang state. There's much less evidence on whether these attempts at conquest were successful. And if so, how such conquered territories would in fact be incorporated into the state. Other oracle bones refer to levies of farmers and workers. They ask questions about the particular times at which groups of farmers and workers should be raised, brought up for military campaigns, mobilized for military campaigns. But it's not clear on what basis, territory, kinship, occupation, these levies were actually raised. By the ruler himself, by members of his family, by other members of the nobility, by vassals. Who's actually taking the responsibility for raising the manpower that's necessitated for state functions? Warfare, communal building projects, and so on. It's certainly true that in this Shang Dynasty case, in contrast to, for example, Harappa, we have lots of evidence for warfare and military activities. Similar kinds of levies seem to have been demanded by the ruler and the nobility for periodic labor by common people in their fields to produce the crops and other resources needed to sustain the nobility, as well as in other kinds of communal labor, as I noted. For example, in road repair and the maintenance of urban defensive walls. This is the kind of system, a form of taxation and labor, that we often find in early states before well-developed taxation systems come into being. Under these circumstances, elite groups sustain themselves on the products of their estates. But they do so because they can force commoners to donate the labor necessary to maintain those estates. It's interesting to note that the bones and shells used during these divination rituals, used during the oracle bone rituals, seem to have been archived. And it's possible that preparing such ceremonies and archiving the results, archiving the divination rituals themselves, was a primary task of a developing Shang palace literate bureaucracy. Shang writing does occur, as I said, in one other context as well, as characters cast onto the exterior of bronze ritual vessels during the late Shang period. This style of writing on these bronze vessels would become far more common during the succeeding Zhou dynasty. Obviously, the context of the writing on bronze ritual vessels was quite different than the questions carved onto flat pieces of animal bone or turtle shell and used in rituals of divination. Bronze vessels used in serving food and drink during courtly ceremonies were exceptionally valuable objects not to be destroyed. There are, however, close relations between these two contexts. The court ceremonies in question often involved sacrifices, and at least some of the bronze vessels were actually used in cooking those sacrifices. Again, the concerns of the human and supernatural worlds are closely entwined. The texts in these cases on these bronze vessels commemorate significant events in the life of the ruler and at court. Oracle bones and bronze inscriptions share a vital characteristic. Both involved aspects of communication with the supernatural, either through divination or sacrifice, perhaps to the spirits of revered ancestors. Of course, what none of this gives us is insights into the day-to-day working of Shang society in ways that we certainly do get in, for example, Mesopotamia, where we can track economic transactions and in later times diplomacy and other such activities. Chinese writing from the Shang period is writing from the top down, quite unconcerned with, for example, commoners in their lives In this way, it resembles the ways that we know the Egyptian writing system worked. The Oracle Bone inscriptions certainly do give us a lot of information on rule, though, and on the ideologies and justifications of rule. Thus, in the next lecture, we'll examine the ideological ways in which rule may have been supported in Shang and the succeeding Zhou period in China, as revealed by oracle bone texts, other archaeological finds, and later historical sources. Thank you.